If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remembrance of the city of God, which had been shown, but every night come out these envoys of beauty and the light the universe with their admonishing smile?
Is that Shakespeare?
Emerson.
King? Tolkien?
Ralph Waldo Emerson?
J.K. Rowling? Ernest Cline?
Dr. Seuss?
Beam these two out of here. Welcome to Discoville, where we discuss both Star Trek Discovery and the Orville here on the Fandom Podcast Network. On this show, we take an in-depth look at each of these shows and discover that both of them can coexist in today's fandom as they introduce us to fresh, new, and exciting stories, characters, galactic destinations, poetry, and so much more. I'm Norm, one of your co-pilots here on Discoville, but you know I don't do my poetry readings alone, and with me on our Quantum Drive Orville rewatch here on Discoville, in the co-pilot seat is Mr. Kevin, the hipster snapper, right soul.
How's it going, man? It's good to be back. Are you sure that wasn't King or Tolkien?
I'm pretty sure it was David Emerson and Lake and Palmer.
Lake and Palmer. And some Nash and Crosby, too.
That's right. And if any of you guys are getting those references, you're as old as we are. Thank you very much. Also back with us here in the shuttle pod is our chief engineer and the man who keeps the FPN bioship from crashing into stars, Mr. Kyle Wagner. Nice name. No, it isn't. So,
Well, there's only one way to respond to that. Mm. I am 16 going on 17.
Oh, God, I love that. Don't you love how that just trails off into space?
Now I want some Rocky Road.
I know. Oh, so good. So good. So we are here on our Quantum Drive rewatch for a very special episode. The episode is Season 1 of the Orville, Episode 4, If the Stars Should Appear. But before we get into that rewatch and take a look back at that episode, Kevin, would you mind opening up Hailing Frequencies and let our fans know how they can find us or how they can find where to get Rocky Road and a copy of Sound of Music online?
Rocky Road, probably your local store, and Sound of Music, Amazon. But if you want to find the shows here on the Fandom Podcast Network, our master feed is at fpnet.podbean.com. The FPNet is also on the Podbean app. You can find the Fandom Podcast Network on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play for you Android users. Discoville is also on Twitter at DiscovillePod and also on Instagram at DiscovillePod. And please check out the Fandom Podcast Network on Facebook and also the Discoville Facebook group. Discoville, search it, get you on there. If you'd like to contact us directly, you can hail us through email at thefandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com or at Discoville directly at discovillepodcast@gmail.com. I'm Kevin. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at @Spartan_Phoenix. Norman, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at @GoingOn17. I'm just kidding. It's stuck in my head. This is your fault, Kyle. Starfighter1701 and on Instagram at @SoCalSource.
Kyle, where can we find you on social media?
You can find me on social media at Deftone A Kyle W or on Instagram at can't sing for a damn A Kyle Fandom.
Can't sing. I don't know. I thought you were great. There was so much Liesl in those tones.
No. Please also visit our Tee Public store where you can help support the Fandom Podcast Network while wearing your favorite show logos, including Discoville with pride. Go ahead and go to Tee Public store and search Fandom Podcast Network. Also, please give us a review on iTunes. We'd love some more reviews. Head on over to iTunes, search Fandom Podcast Network. And if you love what you're hearing on Discoville, let us know in the review. We'll pay it forward and give you some shout out in a future episode.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And it's time to now to engage the quantum drive. Let's slingshot all the way back to September 28th of 2017 and look back at the Orville Season 1 and how it changed, at least for all of us and hopefully for all of you, how it changed the landscape of primetime science fiction TV. And we have kind of a little bit of an extra wait for Season 2 as it's going to debut December 30th now, I believe. Is that correct? 30th or 31st?
Yeah, right around there.
Yeah, so we're going to ring in the new year. Yeah, we're going to ring in the new year basically with a new episode.
Well, technically, it's going to be the last episode of last season. Remember that?
Technically, yeah. Well, is it going to open up with the...
Yeah, because remember, they took that 13th episode that was going to be the season finale of of Orville, and now that's going to be the first episode of Season 2.
No, wait. Longest wait for a season finale ever, except for Game of Thrones.
Yeah, pretty much. It's going to be nearly 12 months for a whole new
Battlestar
season.
Battlestar Galactica do that too, I think. Took forever.
Oh, something like that. Yeah. Anywho, so let's sit back, unzip those uniform jackets. Let's go off duty as we head into the officer's lounge. So during our season one rewatch here on Discoville for the Orville, there'll be a lot of spoiler heavy discussion. So if you haven't seen the Orville at all, please pause the show and start watching. We have already gone through episodes 1, 2, and 3 during our rewatch. So you might want to go all the way back to episode 1 if you haven't watched any of the Orville at all. And make sure that you know what's going on before you listen to this podcast. Then you can come back, unpause the show, and then listen to us as we're yammering along and catch up to what we're talking about on this episode. So previously on the Quantum Drive rewatch on 22, we discussed probably one of the most pivotal episodes and probably the most important episode, I think, in the Orville. That was A Bout of Girl. And Kevin and I talked about that at length. But Kyle, since you're on the show, we really wanted to hear what you thought about a girl, and you were in that same kind of text message, private message frenzy when we were all watching it live, and we were just blown away by what happened. So let us know your thoughts on About a Girl.
Well, excuse me if I'm a little out of breath. I just ran to Baskin-Robbins real quick to get some Rocky Road. What was funny is the guy who gave me the ice cream looked a little like Paul Rudd.
Oh, really?
But no, About a Girl... right now for me is the Orville episode. I think this was the episode that turned the Orville into the direction that none of us saw coming. And I think it's the episode that saved that show. I think if you don't have About a Girl, you don't have season 2 of the Orville. I think it was that important to the series because I think the word of mouth on that series and just how shocking it was to have such a powerful episode on the show, I think to a lot of people, really opened a lot of eyes, because I know I talked to a lot of people and said who were like ready to give up on the Orville after episode 2 and they hadn't watched episode 3 yet. And I said, you have to watch episode 3. It will change how you view everything about this show. And everybody came back and it was like that eyes wide open look, like you were so right. Or wow, I can't believe they went in that direction. It makes me rethink this whole show. And a lot of people actually went back and watched episodes 1 and 2 afterwards and they had a different feel for it after About a Girl. And without that, I like I said, I don't think we're sitting here getting ready for season 2, even though it's not till December.
Was there a particular scene or sequence of events that really sticks with you in that episode?
You know what? End of that, it's when you see Bordas really change his mind about the sex change operation. And of course, on the funny side of it, the whole Rudolph thing with him and... The crew, and that was great. But just seeing how much he stood by his convictions, and I thought really a lot of stuff in the courtroom when that whole thing was going on was just so powerful, and it was actually very intense. Even when they did comedy stuff like they did with Malloy, there was still a heavy feel about this because it was such a heavy topic. And I think that was just brilliant. It's one of the most brilliant pieces of writing for a TV series in 2018, I think.
Yeah, it was a very profound episode. And if you haven't watched it, you really should see episode 3 of the Orville, About a Girl, and then listen to our podcast, episode 22, where we discuss that in depth. But now we're going into episode 4 of the first season of the Orville, If the Stars Should Appear. And this was written by Seth MacFarlane and directed by James L. Conway. Now, James L. Conway has done a lot of Star Trek. So if these shows are getting very Trek-like, it's because there's a lot of Star Trek alumni involved. But I'd also be remiss if I don't mention the just incredible score by Joel McNeely. And not just in this episode, but I like this episode's score quite a bit. But for the series in total, because one of the things that strikes me about this series is how good the music is. And I think the music tends to give it a little bit more credence and gravitas and a lot more believability as a more of a serious show. Kevin, do you think that's the case with the music?
Oh, totally. It catches you right at the beginning of the show where it has a very Star Trek-y Next Gen Deep Space Nine Voyager theme going on there, where you have the beauty shots of the USS Orville either flying or going through nebulas, and it catches you right away. And Seth knows this guy. They go back a long way. He was a composer for A Million Ways to Die in the West. And Kyle, guess what? He was also the composer for Soldier, the kind of sideways sequel, as we call it, to Blade Runner, starring Kurt Russell.
Don't go there, Kevin.
But he's also worked on American Dad. He's done a bunch of other stuff as well. So, but it's just the score. I think that was a conversation that Seth MacFarlane had to have specifically, that we have to have a score, someone that can do this show justice in the way that these other science fiction shows have had great scores.
Yeah, absolutely. As the episode opens, we see that not all is happy in the Bordas and Clyde in domesticated partnership, as they are struggling with the realities of what it means to live on a Union ship, as duties drive Bordas to his station and Clyden to Rocky Road Ice Cream and the Sound of Music for comfort. Meanwhile, the Orville and her crew encounters an immense 2,000-year-old derelict ship drifting into a star. Merson, Grayson, and Catan, Finn, and Isaac enter, discovering an artificial biosphere and a civilization of 3 million who worship an entity called Dural and do not know that they are on a ship. Grayson is held prisoner by their theocratic dictator, Hamilak. Nice name. No, it's not. Who imposes a death penalty on the reformers who believe anything exists beyond the known world. While Bordas takes the Orville to save a colony ship from a Krill attack, Grayson's crewmates rescue her and lead a group of reformers to the alien ship's bridge. An ancient recording from Captain Jehavis Dural, played by Liam Neeson, reveals that it was a generation ship disabled by an ion storm. Isaac initiates repairs and opens the hull's window, enabling the populace to see the stars for the first time, moving even Hamilak. Mercer makes arrangements for the Union to train the people to operate their ship. Meanwhile, Clyden is frustrated that Bordas' duties continue to leave him little time for their family. So that is, in a nutshell, episode 4. And first, before we jump into that, I'd like to take a little bit of time discussing some of the really fantastic guest stars. Hamilak, played by Robert Knepper. What did you guys think of him? We've seen him before. I think that all of us being Next Generation fans and Next Generation fans out there would remember him in that episode Haven, you know, where he played Wyatt. He was like an artist, and he got these dreams of who his perfect wife should be.
Right. And oh, God, he was so that's young in that episode, too.
All right, and he had super big Stan Kirsch, Richie Ryan hair, right? That was like in the mid-80s. But he's done a couple other things. He's been in Carnival. a couple of notable, big notable things, but he's been in the business forever. So I think he was a home run as Hamilak. I thought he brought a lot to the role. What'd you guys think?
I thought so. He's a very iconic character actor, probably better known as Theodore Teabag Bagwell in Prison Break TV series. I was watching that show for quite a while. Really liked him. I even saw the direct-to-video Hard Target 2, where he plays the bad guy in that. He usually plays the heavy. He's been doing a lot of work. He's been on Homeland, iZombie. He's just got a very distinctive, not only look, but the way that he delivers his lines. And he's one of those character actors that I think any show just loves to have on as a guest.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Kyle?
Oh, no, I completely agree with everything Kevin said. And you know what? He's got one of those faces that even if you're not familiar with his name, as soon as you see him, he's like, oh, I know that guy. Mm-hmm. From something. But I thought he was especially good in this episode as Hamlet because there was a true sense of, I don't want to say evil, but of control and on a power trip and feeling like he knew best for everybody. And I think that was actually it's a very key thing about this episode that I'll get to later. But I thought he was great in this episode as Hamlet and really hit on a lot of different notes with this character in a short period of time.
We have another kind of science fiction fan favorite here in this episode. And I know, yeah. Kevin, you were a big fan of this show, Space Above and Beyond. We had James Morrison as Kempka. So I know that we all enjoyed him. But he was kind of in a different type of role here. I mean, he wasn't T.C. McQueen. You know, he was, I don't know. It did you feel like the character, this Kempka, this reformist leader, fit him?
Oh, totally. I thought so. When I saw him, I was like, yes. He fits that role to a T, the leader of the rebellion or something like that. And I loved him as Bill Buchanan in 24. But, of course, the short-lived Space Above and Beyond, another Fox-canceled TV series, loved him as Lieutenant Colonel Tyus Cassius. He's just got this commanding performance. And his look, and of course that iconic voice. He's just got that iconic voice, and you know, in this episode, you really get to see why people are following him, and he's the go-to guy.
Absolutely, I mean he has that Stephen Lang kind of voice.
I was just thinking that, yeah. I would love to see those two team up. You know,
maybe those guys should play like Cable's doppelgangers or something. We had Max Burkholder as Tomalin, young kid. He's a voice actor on Family Guy, American Dad. He was in Parenthood. But, Kyle, you brought this to my attention. There was an unknown actor kind of towards the end of this episode. Maybe you'd like to, I don't know, maybe you can break him out into this, you know, whole realm of like entertainment. Why don't you be the guy who lets everybody know and how you discovered this particular actor?
You know, I follow this guy in a lot of, you know, he's done a lot of interesting smaller films.
I think he should be taken out of those smaller roles.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. But you know, he's also very famous for a lot of interesting voice acting work. He voiced a very well known lion a couple of times. He always comes across in a great mentor role. That's really his niche, I think, is kind of in a mentor, whether it's, you know, bringing up young kids and trying to teach them certain ways, or even as a warrior trainer. You know, he was very good in a couple of small budget films where he was training, you know, being a mentor to an up and coming warrior. And, you know, he's got that distinctive accent, and the name is fairly common. I mean, come on, I know a lot of Liams. It's, you know.
Well, he's, you know, he used to be a supporting actor, but he is not a backup actor or a dark man no more.
Yes.
We're talking, of course, of the legendary Liam Neeson.
And you guys I'll tell you just what. Dragging that out for so long. It's like, say his name. Oh, come on. Say his name.
We were doing it just to torture you, Kevin. We didn't have the injection, so we were just doing that to torture you. But you know what? The thing I just got to throw out about this was probably the biggest surprise cameo of any of the cameos on Orville this season, because nobody saw that coming.
Yes, they did not advertise his appearance at all.
I thought it was absolutely wonderful that they did that. And you know what? It's great. What I love about Liam Neeson is, here's a guy who embraces whether it's television or film. I mean, he made a big push to actually play Ra's al Ghul on Arrow, even though, well, he's like, I'll do it for free.
And they should have.
And they should have. But, I mean, that's what's so great about Liam Neeson. And, you know, that's one of the things that makes the Orville special is because of Seth MacFarlane and his connections, he's able to get his friends on, and they're glad to do it. I mean, and I think that's going to be something we're going to see more of.
You know, it's funny, when he was when Seth was talking about getting him to be a co-star on Million Ways to Die in the West, Liam said, can I keep my normal accent? He says, sure. And I'm sure the other side of that was, but I got this TV show I need to do a quick guest spot on. Is that fine?
Yeah. We'll shoot it in a bathroom in Spain and see if we can like knock down the... that's a Highlander reference, folks. Listen to Blood of Kings to get that reference. So yes, we had great guest stars in this, and they get better and better and better. And we actually, in the next episode, I'm not going to jump ahead, but in the next episode, we're going to have another of not only Seth MacFarlane's co-stars, but Liam Neeson's co-stars as well in the next episode of The Orville. So let's talk about what we remember from when we first saw this. So this came out on September 28th, 2017. For me, coming off of About a Girl, that's kind of like setting the bar really, really, really high. So you're expecting an episode to kind of either match it or exceed it. And I know that's kind of unfair when it comes to television. But I felt that when I saw it, there was a really interesting thing that Seth brought in with the writing that was kind of like this whole kind of clash between faiths. I also saw a lot of the original series kind of in this episode, the Star Trek original series. I felt that there was very much like Return of the Archons with Landru and the supercomputer that kind of takes control over the entire population. There's another episode in season 3 called For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, where they actually run into an asteroid generational ship, much like this generational biosphere ship in this episode. So I guess I'm going to get to a different set of opinions later on, but from when I first saw it, I really liked it. I thought they were taking interesting chances, and it felt like a really nice amalgamation of the spirit of the original series and the Next Generation. Kyle, let's start with you. What did you think about this when you first saw it?
You know, when I first saw it, I felt like an episode of Next Generation. It's the first of this Orville shows that really felt like, okay, this is really feeling like Star Trek. About a Girl was very powerful, and it had some Star Trek feels into it, but this is the one that really feels like, man, this could have just easily been an episode of Next Generation without a doubt to me. But there was also something about this story. I don't want to say it was bad, but it felt a little flat at times to me, but how it resolved and getting the Liam Neeson thing at the end really just kind of gave that whole episode a boost. And I walked away feeling good about this episode. But again, like you said, Norman, too, following up from About a Girl, I think it kind of like, there was no way it could match that. But like you, in a rewatch, there's some things I realize now about the importance of this episode that I'm going to address in a little bit. But this episode is a lot more important than I think what people realize.
And do you remember, Kevin, like, were there anything that significantly stood out to you in this episode? Was it what you wanted? Was it not what you wanted? What happened when you first saw it?
I want to echo a little bit about what Kyle was saying. I kind of agree with that. Coming after About a Girl, it was a serviceable episode. I think the overall plot of the ship and the people on there not knowing what was going on, being ruled by somewhat of a dictator is typical Star Trek type of trope or story. But I felt that it was more paying tribute than kind of copying, which I thought was nice. I liked the location shots. But to be honest with you, my favorite parts of this episode weren't the whole big A story. It was actually the stuff that was going on between the crew, whether it was Bordas and Clyden or Kelly and the girls talking about, you know, the boyfriends before they get attacked by those sentry guys. And then just little awkward things, that the awkward elevator ride and then finding also that Claire, the doctor, is, you know, afraid of heights. That was the kind of stuff I really pulled from more than the story itself. I thought it wasn't like, you know, I thought it was kind of a little bit of a step down after seeing a really great episode with About a Girl, but it was still enjoyable.
Well, I mean, that's some of the things that, would you say that that's what you got out of the rewatch? Some of these newer things?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the rewatch, I kind of appreciated the little things with the conversation between the crew, especially, you know, when you have the helmsman, you know, talking about how bored they are, star mapping, and, you know, and then, yeah, you know, talking about, you know, comparing, you know, who would have it worse, you know, with friends going on vacation and sharing stuff, you know, just little right, stuff like that.
There were some smart moments with characterizations. There's one in particular that I'm going to mention later on. But Kyle, what did you get out of this rewatch?
Okay, this is where I really, my view on this changed as I was rewatching this and thinking about how important this episode is. About a Girl cemented the foundation for the Orville. And what made this episode so key was because this could have gone in very different directions. They could have gone with a full comedy episode to lighten things up after having such a heavy episode with About a Girl. But they went the direction they did. And what I kind of feel is About a Girl was the foundation. This episode, I think, laid the support beams for the rest of the show because people saw, you know what? He's continuing with the Star Trek type feel to this. He's taking it seriously. Yes, it has these comedic moments in it, but he's keeping a fairly serious tone to this. And one of the things I did that also kind of stood out to me as in the importance of this was it continued something that they started with episode two, which carried into episode three with obviously the birth of the baby, but they were still continuing on with the effects of everything that Clytus and Bortus went through. And they were still having episodes with their relationship where maybe in the Next Generation, you don't have that running through the season, but they developed that, hey, we're going to have storylines that are going to run through at least half our season, if not the whole season. And I think that was something people actually liked. And I know that's a lot of people, that was one of the knocks a lot of people have on, especially Next Generation. Everything was so clean and tight in one episode, and there was not a lot of carryover.
I mean, one of the things I think that, and I agree with you that helps, is that it makes you care about the characters, not just the main characters, but kind of like the secondary characters. That's what I always felt was really strong about shows like, you know, Star Trek shows like Deep Space Nine, is that you actually cared about the secondary characters almost as much or more than like the central characters. I mean, we actually do care about what happens to Clyden, and eventually we're going to meet, you know, Claire Finn's sons, and we have all these extra characters, you know, like Chief Engineer Newton and what happens to him. But when I got through with my rewatch of this episode, one of the things that really stood out to me was I really thought that Robert Knepper's character, his portrayal of Hamilak, was so good. I don't think that this episode would have worked as well if they didn't cast the right person. I really do think they cast the right person because he has like the right mix of authoritarian but kind of snively at the same time, and kind of cowardly if it weren't for his power. The power that was in some way, either he stole it or it was bestowed upon him. So I thought that he was really good. I do like those moments. I really did like the conversation between Alara and Kelly when they're just talking about guys. You know, it was just a very kind of natural conversation. But the one thing that kind of bugged me a little bit, and it does bug me with almost every science fiction show that I watch, is that I wish that in some way they were able to work just a second or two of why they can understand each other when you have this union ship of humans and some aliens find a 2,000-year-old ship from a completely different civilization, and everyone's talking kind of colloquial / slang English.
Marcus, the only show that ever solved that.
Yeah, right. With the microbes, right? The translator microbes. It just kind of bugs me, just because there are ways in today's science fiction that you can get around doing that, whether it's a universal translator or some kind of linguist or something. I mean, even Enterprise tried to attempt that with Hoshi. It sometimes worked, it sometimes didn't, but all of a sudden, boom, 2,000-year-old ship, 2,000-year-old civilization, and everyone's kind of like, where's your garbage? Where's your napkin? You know, the conversation's too easy. Now, yeah, I get it. We have to kind of get the story moving, but it only takes a second or two to say, like, you know, their comm scanner can translate their language, or it's based on some type of basic or binary code. That's, you know, they do such a great job with everything else. That's the only kind of stumbling block that I see. So I don't. Do you guys agree or disagree with that?
That didn't bother me.
No, I think that,
no. But I see
think
your
with
point.
The Orville, yeah. You let it slide.
Yeah, I get kind of nerdy that way. I'm kind of like sticker for nerdy tropish stuff. So in this rewatch, did anything work better for you? Did things fall flat? Did this episode pretty much remain the same when you first saw it back in September? So where does this now sit as you're rewatching it in kind of like the whole narrative thread of the Orville? Now, Kyle, you said that things improved for you in a certain way in this rewatch.
Yeah, again, I kind of go back to where I think what makes this episode work is the fact it does continue the foundation that was built on from episode three, About a Girl, because it's continuing a bit of a more of a serious tone with some lighthearted comic moments. And one of the things I also noticed that was the humor in this episode a little bit more, especially how they kind of worked it in with Isaac still trying to adapt to human culture and learn about it. And you have the whole, oh, that's a compliment when it's not meant to be. And they kind of kept that a little bit of a running joke. There was one thing I noticed in this episode too that maybe I didn't quite pick up on, and I'm curious, they didn't really follow up on this, but when Kelly and Alara are having their conversation, Did you get a kind of feeling that maybe Alara was kind of having a little bit of a crush on Mercer, and that's why she was asking questions?
You can see that, yeah. Yeah, you can see that, I think.
And that was just, it was a little thing I noticed. I know they didn't play up on it, but I just was one of those things that it's like, well, that's kind of interesting. And she had another moment that was a really nice little touch right after she had been shot and Finn brings her to recovery. While Ed is talking, you see her mouth thank you to the doctor. And I thought that was, whether that was an improv move or what, I thought that was a nice little touch in the episode as well. Mm-hmm.
How about you, Kevin? Do you get anything new? Did anything really change for you in this rewatch? Anything that kind of colors your opinion now of how the story goes forward?
When I started looking back on the whole of Orville season one as a whole, I started thinking about my favorite episodes. Now, let me preface it by saying I love all these episodes. There isn't a stinker among any of these. But when I start to kind of do my internal ranking system, I started to feel this one actually was down towards the bottom. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I don't know if it's something I've already kind of touched on and you know, what I know is coming as opposed to what I've also already seen. But that's kind of was what's been laying kind of heavy is that it's, I think it's one of my least favorites, even though I still watch it, you know? So, yeah.
Now I see where you're getting, you know, you're getting at with this. There wasn't really a lot that was moving kind of like the plot forward. There was a lot that was moving like character interaction forward,
yes,
which I think was important.
Yeah, I think it was more of a character development episode and kind of the crew working together more and stuff like that, as opposed to, you know, what's, you know, this is kind of one of those episodes. Other than the scenes with Bordas and Clyden, really there isn't much else moving the main story forward, even though I know that these were all written in a specific order to kind of keep certain things going and popping up. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah, for me in this episode, some of the things that fell flat for me were the scenes when Kelly was being tortured and kind of like her quips of and retorts against Hamilak. I don't know. It just, I know that you probably love the Friends reference. I get that,
yes,
you know, which is kind of funny. But it's not that it seemed out of character for her because she's super tough. And I love Adrienne Pilecki. I love how she's kind of like, you know, shaped this character of Kelly Grayson. But there's just something in that interrogation scene that was just not working for me. I don't know what it is. And maybe it's just because it was a little too ham-handed. Kyle, what did you think about that?
Well, I want to bring up a point because I'm curious if maybe this might have affected you as far as that interrogation scene. It's because of our love of Adrian Padalecki as Bobby in S.H.I.E.L.D. And it felt like she was more like channeling that character at the time than she was Kelly, by with the quippy remarks in an interrogation scene. That's kind of how I felt about it. It's like, so yeah. And then again, that's being influenced by her role in another show.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it would be interesting to like hear a bunch of different opinions about that particular scene, because you're right. We were so invested in S.H.I.E.L.D. and then she was just like right off of it. She was just like written out of season three.
That's not what bothered me, because I'm not familiar with the character that much in S.H.I.E.L.D. It was more of the character that, I'm sorry, what's his name? Robert Neppert, Hamilak, was playing. I felt that he wasn't trying enough to try and believe what she was saying or not, you know, or I felt like, cause he was very single-minded in interrogating her. And there was just something for me that didn't quite sit there either, because of how drastically she was dressed, the technology she had with her, you know, obviously he wants to know where her friends are, and not taking for what she said when she was telling the truth right away, for you know, and trying to get that, unless he was trying to put on a show for his guards, you know. I mean, if he was a smart leader, and if he kind of knows, like towards later in the episode, when he has a sense that there is something out there, but he's trying to keep a lid on it, that's just part of it kind of bugged me as well.
Yeah, it was a little uneven. Now, I see what you're getting at, but they do kind of address that a little bit. I'm going to kind of like address that in my own Mega 13 pick, but you're right. There are two ways of looking at that. He could have been kind of like this ridiculously like one-sided zealot-like leader who's just like, whatever you say doesn't matter because there's no other belief but my belief. And then there are those leaders like later on, almost kind of like, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in the season one review here. But remember the very final episode, Mad Idolatry, where you're dealing with different faiths and the way that it developed. This episode felt like it was kind of almost kind of like a writer's dry run at that episode. Like they're trying to figure out what they want to do with clashing faiths and clashing belief systems. And they got all the stuff that they didn't want in a better episode. And that better episode was Mad Idolatry. So, you know, because you're dealing with a lot better tolerance levels mm-hmm. with people.
And yeah, that's a good point.
Is that fair to say? I mean, I don't want to, like I said, like, don't I'll jump all the way to episode 12, but that's where I felt like we were going with this episode. It felt like a dry run of a lot of things. Was there anything that you guys would have changed in this episode? Was there something that, like, you thought was a kernel of a good idea and probably would have worked better for you even more if they just kind of tweaked it a little bit?
I think for me, what I would have changed is, you know, I wish we would have seen some consideration from the Orville crew of how, what this, of like, do we have the right to make this drastic change to this society? Because it's almost where we have Hemlock trying to control everybody in the old ways. Here's the Orville crew and make decisions for those people. Here's the Orville crew making a decision for those people. So in their own way, they were kind of doing the same thing Hemlock was doing, but because they were putting what they thought was right onto these people. So I wish they would have at least put a little bit more weight into that aspect of it mm-hmm. instead of just mm-hmm. like, oh, hit the switch.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen James Morrison's character and Robert Nepper's character actually interact. And I would have loved to have seen Robert Nepper's character actually join them on that elevator ride, you know, like them kind of. I think them being two different people and believing two different things, it'd been nice to have seen them together and maybe come together as opposed to not be together at all. And then for them both to see the message by Liam Neeson's character.
I absolutely 100% agree with both of you. I think that would have been a great moment where you have these two characters with two different opposing sides of the equation come together and say like, okay, you know what? We were both fighting for the same cause, except we were on the opposite extremes of that cause. And now with Dural giving us his message and we're seeing it in person, they should have been the ones that have agreed on opening that the sunroof, as Ed called it, and letting all these people in on this is who we are, this is what's happening, and these are the changes that need to be made. The big thing that really, really bothered me in this episode was the fact that Mercer took it upon himself to completely change the philosophy and the idealism of this entire culture by opening those doors. Like, they've never seen night, right? So could you imagine, like, if we, well, maybe, I know Kyle probably has seen, like, Eternal Day since you lived in Alaska, right?
And but, Eternal Night.
Yeah, but could you imagine, like, living in Eternal Day for all these years, and that's all you knew, that was your society, that was your biosphere, and all of a sudden, boom, blackout. Well, I mean, you wouldn't look up at there like in wonder. You would be in freaking panic mode.
Yeah, you've heard right? your history lessons of what the Mayans and ancient cultures happened when there was like, you know, an eclipse, and they think they were losing the sun.
I mean, they would freak out. I mean, that's the kind of thing that it just felt too. We got 30 to 45 seconds to wrap up a TNG episode. Let's everyone be okay with this and then make that decision. Okay. I just didn't feel like, for as strong as a Bout of Girl was. Again, holding that as the high watermark for the Orville, I just didn't feel like the resolution of this episode felt like it was well thought through. Like, hey, you know what? Let's take an entire belief system and turn it on its head just because Ed Mercer says so, because he's the Federation, right?
Let me ask you guys something real quick. This is one of those times where I would love, maybe in season two, that they have to revisit this ship for some reason. Mm-hmm. And they actually see the impact of what they did on this population.
Right.
I would love this to be, these are kind of the characters that could be coming. I mean, Hemlock was so powerful a character. This is a character who I would love to see again. And I'd love to see maybe these people be a recurring character in the Orville going forward.
So you're saying that you want to see the Orville to the Wrath of Hemlock.
There we go. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
This being Space Seed. So I guess that I think it's fair to say for all of us that there were good ideas, there were great character interactions, but there were just some things that I think didn't fall into place the way that, say, About a Girl fell into place. But it's so hard to keep saying, like, About a Girl did this and About a Girl did that, because it was a damn near perfect episode. And everything after that, it's almost unfair to compare against, just in terms of where it needs to be. So I thought it was a fun episode. Again, I agree with you guys. I thought that, you know, some of the things fell flat, but anything in this episode, like, really radically changed your original opinion, or just kind of like minorly changed the way you felt about it?
I think for me, it was more of it following up About a Girl and the importance of it following that episode, and kind of really, as even though it wasn't the best episode of the Orville, it was good enough to establish the path the Orville was taking. And I think that's what a lot of people, because I think if they would have went with a hard comedy episode after such an amazing episode, it could have turned a lot of people off again.
That's a good point, Kyle. It obviously didn't reach the epicness that About a Girl had, but it still kind of kept Orville on pace and lets you know this is the direction we're still taking. We're doing this kind of Star Trek thing still with, you know, the drama, with a little bit more humor, and, you know, making the getting to know, you're still getting to know the characters and the crew, and you got to know a little bit more about that in this episode. So yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, for me, again, it's the whole who has the right and who has the authority to do what they have done in this episode. Did Hamlet have the right to completely suppress an entire generation's worth of, you know, of these people's culture religiously? Did Ed Mercer have the right just to kind of like upend it all because he felt like he had the authority to do so as part of this union? That's something about Star Trek that still kind of like bothers me a little bit about the authority of the Federation, because he really didn't have authority over these people in a political or governmental, military or religious sense. You know, he just kind of said, no, this is wrong. This is morally wrong. Just do it. Just change everything and let the chips fall where they may. So with, on one hand, you had Hamilak. On the other hand, you had the other leader. And they're like, well, you know, they're fundamentally different, but now we're just going to send like a bunch of like union techs to like try and like, you know, sort it all out. But thanks, guys. You know, that was a fantastic discussion on this episode. But now it's time on Discoville to activate the Omega 13, because we're all Galaxy Quest fans, and it's time to choose that particular moment in this episode where we activate the Omega 13 technology, which allows 13 seconds of time to be rewritten or to relive something or even possibly correct a mistake. So in this episode, if the stars should appear, what was your Omega 13 moment? Kyle, let's start with you.
Okay, I'm actually going to change up from what I have in the notes, because it's something we haven't talked about in this episode. It's the segment with the battle against the Krill where we see Lamar. We see our first signs of Lamar and just how intelligent he is, with him noticing how much damage they've done to the engines, and they hand him over weapon control and he takes out the Krill ship. I think that, looking back now after watching the whole Orville season, what great foreshadowing in that scene for that character.
I think you also want to yell out a certain line.
Boom!
Yeah, exactly.
Boom!
Yeah.
Boom!
Boom!
But you know what I love about that scene is that he's kind of crowing and he's got kind of doing his victory dance and Bortus kind of like slaps him down. But at the same time, he's like, well done, Lieutenant. You know, I'm like, yeah, it was boom. That's a great pick. How about you, Kevin?
I was thinking about this. I was like, you know, 13 seconds isn't a lot to do much with, but I thought it would have been really cool. And I found this fascinating, the scene with Liam Neeson's character doing his video, his character of Dural, talking about the ship. This ship was going on a trip for three generations. There would have been two generations of people that were basically populating the ship, keeping it going, sustaining it, and they weren't going to reach their destination until the third generation was born and ready. Then the problem started happening. And I would have loved to have had at least a 10-second little thing, maybe even 13, of them kind of showing a little backstory video like superimposed with the video of Dural showing what was happening with this. And I thought that would have been really cool to get a little backstory with what the original colonists on this ship were doing when it first started. Because I thought that was fascinating, that line that he said, that the third generation of these people were going to be the ones that were going to see this. The first generation was going to die off before they even saw any of this. So you saw the people that took off on this ship weren't going to see its eventual destination. Think about that for a second.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's, again, that's going into deeper science fiction, you know, where...
I wanted to get deep with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, from what I understand, when the Orville was doing its initial scan of the biosphere, they were cleaning off the designation of that ship, and I believe they were able to etch out the letters G-A-L-A-T, something like that, Galactica, I think it was. Crossing the streams. For me, there was a really great scene with Hamilak when he was the post-interrogation scene when they saved Kelly from the truth serum, and he said that, is it possible that there's more to the universe than what we see? Yes, it's possible. So you know that he's not 100% completely shut off from the fact that there are other powers in the universe. And then Claire said, then for God's sake, why don't you let us help you? We can try to repair your ship. And this is probably like the most telling line here. He said, to do so, as you say, will shatter our entire way of life. The world is not ready. And then, you know, Ed follows up with, you know, ready for you to let go of control. I think that's unjust in a way when Ed said that, because look at the reality of the situation. The reality is that if you do what you say you're going to do, you're going to take 3 million people and completely tell them everything that they've believed in for generations is a lie. I mean, yeah. Think about that. And I mean, think about that in real world terms. Now, yeah, Hamilak is, you know, he's not a great leader, but he understands how to maintain order. And I think that's probably a little, remember, Kevin, I messaged you this and I said that I'm probably going to defend Hamilak a little bit here.
Yeah.
No, I don't defend his methods, and I don't defend his tactics, but I do defend the logic of what he needs to do here. I mean, again, if you took an entire society and had 100% positive proof and put it out on every possible loudspeaker and social media post that you could and say that this is the truth and your religion is wrong and everything that you believed in and your parents believed in and your children and their grandchildren and everybody for the last 2,000 years since the beginning of time, since the birth of Christ, was wrong. How do you think people would react to that, really?
Right, yeah. And he just could, could have, you know, led with a little bit of lighter fist, you know.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. Yeah, but it's the whole aspect of what gives Ed the right to do that.
I want to throw out something here based off a point we were just talking about. You're saying this ship is 2,000 years old. How many generations have gone by? Obviously, this was a very technological society to build this kind of ship. But when we look in the biosphere, the conditions and how they're living in. Obviously, for a long time, there were some very heavy-handed people because you would think they would have developed more in a technological way over that 2,000-year period, considering that the fact that the original people on there were from the species that built the ship. So when I think about that, I find that a very interesting dynamic in this episode as well.
Right. There are a lot of textural, conflicts in there between the technological advancement of the people, the engineers that created this. And then all of a sudden, you're like dealing with kind of almost like a medievalism and like peasant farmers and stuff like that. So great conversation, guys, and really fantastic Omega 13 picks. But let's switch it up a little bit here. And Kevin, if you wouldn't mind, and activating subspace signals. Because on Subspace Signals, this is where we discuss what's happening out there on social media concerning special news or updates on Discovery and the Orville. So, Kevin, what'd you figure out? What did you decipher on the Subspace Signals
for this episode? Well, I thought, you know, since we're doing a little bit of a Orville rewatch here, we got to show some Star Trek Discovery love. So I came up with some, usually I like to look at the Twitter feed of the stars and I get some good stories out of that. And there was a tweet that Mary Chifo, if I'm pronouncing her name correctly, from Star Trek Discovery. Of course, she plays Laurel. She's fun to follow on Twitter. She retweeted a story that I thought was very fascinating, and I wanted to share that with you guys. And it's an article by Liz Shannon Miller that was posted on IndieWire called Star Trek Discovery, What It Takes to Survive Hours in the Makeup Chair, According to Doug Jones. Jones and co-star Mary Chifo, as well as the men who make them unrecognizable, reveal the physical and emotional toll of become aliens on screen. And I highly recommend you searching this article out here. You can find Liz Shannon Miller at Liz, L-E-T. And she does a really cool article here talking about the hours in the makeup chair, the things that happen while it's being done. And it's very, very fascinating. Some really cool pictures, too, that show the makeup artist working with the actors, not just during their makeup session, but also the touch-up that's needed afterwards while they're sitting in those, you know, in between takes, and there's those long hours on the set and such. And, you know, they talk about a lot of the stuff here. Like, for example, a few weeks before production began in season two, the IndieWire author here visited Alchemy, which is the studios in San Fernando Valley where a lot of the makeup prosthetics are made. Then they're shipped to Toronto for the set when they're then put on there and then, you know, made to fit the actors and such there. And they showed, they did a tour with an in-depth look on how these effects come alive on the screen. The space filled with models ranging from the character's bust to full-size models was almost entirely devoted to Trek-related elements, including the Klingon torchbearer exosuit in the reception area and at least one of the vintage next-generation Batlas hanging on the office wall. And there's a really cool picture of Mary Chifo with the prosthetic supervisor James McKinnon and the key prosthetics Hugo Valesen putting on her big headpiece, the Klingon headpiece. And she's kind of smiling from the side. And it's really, really cool. And they talk about the history and the other shows that these guys have worked on. And one of the things that I thought was funny, too, is what do you do when you're in this chair for 3 or 4 hours, you know, while this is being done and you're there at 4 in the morning? And the actors did pick up on this, and Chifo said, I tried to come in with a positive attitude and a sense of humor, even if it's 4 a.m. Music plays a big role in the process. While the Alchemy Studios, they play an eclectic selection of heavy metal, punk, and comedy albums. Glenn said he'll frequently begin the day in the makeup trailer by playing classical music. It's really nice, and it chills you out, and it gets your brain firing. But then it says, but usually the people in the chair get to pick the soundtrack. So if you're having makeup put on and you're there for that long, you get to choose. Jones is a big Whitney Houston fan, and 80s pop was in heavy rotation.
Nice.
During season one, Chifo recalled one morning where she, Jones, and co-star Anthony Rapp were all in makeup together, and because they were all music theater people, they weren't shy when it came to singing along with that morning's playlist, even the pop tunes, pretty much any song. We're just willing to go in guns blazing. So it's a really, really great article. I highly recommend that you check that out. IndieWire.com. And I thought it was a really kind of neat look behind the scenes when it comes to the makeup process. Because we always hear about how long it is, but not the actual process itself. So, and by the way, Liz Shannon Miller was is a Los Angeles-based TV editor for IndieWire and has been talking about television on the internet since the very beginnings of the internet. She studied at USC. She was also a staff writer in G4's Attack of the Show, which was one of my favorite shows back in the day. And she's really big into science fiction and such. So make sure you check that out. The other story that I thought was interesting, and this was not on my radar at all. I don't remember seeing anything about it on social media, but I thought it was a really, really cool thing here. There was a kind of a convention, I guess. And so what was interesting about this convention, though, it was one for the ladies. And this was an event called Vulture Festival. It was on Sunday, May 20th, 2018 in New York, and it says, join Star Trek Discovery cast members Sonequa Martin-Green, Mary Chifo, Mary Wiseman, Michelle Yeoh, and executive producer Gretchen J. Berg as they reveal the secrets to their distinctively female forward mission on the CBS all-access series Star Trek Discovery. And it was at Milk Studios at 450 West Street in New York. And tickets were only $30. Includes a complimentary access to the Vulture Lounge following the event. I don't know about you guys, but I would have paid $30 to see these girls talk for an hour.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. Yeah, easily.
So it was a really cool thing. I think, I don't know if it's on YouTube or not. I didn't search that far into it, but they had a really cool event there. And also on StarTrek.com, there is a feature-length article that talks about the highlights from this event. And I highly recommend that you search for that. It's the Vulture event, basically. So, yeah.
Real quick, I'm going to throw in a subspace signal to there, Kevin. Last week on Netflix, season 2 of The Toys That Made Us came out.
Oh,
and they do
yes.
an episode
I'm really glad
based on the
up.
History of Star Trek toys. And towards the end of the episode, they do talk about Diamond Select, who is the current holder of the Star Trek toy license. And they do talk about what they're doing to get ready for Discovery's toy release. But it's a great episode about the crazy history of Star Trek toys and how insane it is. And it's, if you're a Star Trek fan, it's a must. See,
it there was a lot of label slapping, let's put it this way, stuff that had nothing to do with Star Trek that a Star Trek label was slapped on it to try and sell it.
I don't want to watch it because I'm going to cry about how many toys that I've either bought or lost or whatever.
Oh, it is a great watch. Make sure, yeah, Kyle, thank you for bringing that up. The Toys That Made Us, the Star Trek episode. Check that out.
Awesome stuff. Thanks for the subspace signals, guys. So final thoughts for this particular episode. If the stars should appear, Kevin, let's start with you.
Like I said, I love all the episodes of Orville so far. This isn't one of my favorites, but I still watch it, enjoy it. But I was doing a little trivia search on this, and I thought this was interesting. The storyline for this episode mirrors the storyline for the 1970 TV series The Star Lost, came out in 1973, where an agricultural habitat is on a giant ship that had an accident somewhere along the way and is now heading for a collision with a star. The only difference is that the outside crew from the Orville come and roam around the inside of the ship to save it instead of the Star Lost version where members from the agricultural society try to save the ship. So I thought that was interesting.
Would be nice to hear that on the Blu-ray special features if ever we get a Blu-ray notification. All right, Kyle, how about you?
Again, I go back to what I've been saying. I think this was a great follow-up and a great way to lay the foundation for what was coming with the Orville. I think one of the biggest things I pull from this is really Liam Neeson's appearance, because we knew that Charlize Theron was going to be in an episode of the Orville. That was already out there. But having Liam Neeson completely surprise everybody really kind of made people take a step back and go, wow, who else? We know Charlize Theron is coming, but now they've got Liam Neeson out of nowhere. Who else is going to make an appearance in this show? And everybody knowing all the connections Seth MacFarlane has, it could really be anybody. And I think that's one of the things that's kept people watching the Orville, because they were like, who's going to pop up next? And I think that was one of the biggest things about this episode. But again, I think it was not one of the best episodes of the Orville. I think it continued to add support to the amazing foundation that they built with About a Girl going forward. And I think that's what makes this such an important episode when you look back at season 1 of The Orville.
I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, both of those are fair points, both yours and Kevin's. And I think the one thing that we need to realize is that because it's only 12 episodes, you know, there's going to be, you know, fluctuations in what's, I wouldn't even say like what's mediocre, what's good and what's better and what's best. I mean, About a Girl being the best, I would probably say this was in the good. So I thought that this was a fairly decent episode. It had some pretty good broad brushstrokes of where really good narratives could have gone. I just felt that somewhere along the line, they went a little too easy on some of the harder questions. But again, you know, you only have 47, 48, 49 minutes of narrative. So I felt that in some cases they could have nipped and tucked a little bit and probably developed some of the other storylines a little bit more. But aside from that, it was a pretty good episode, but it really did show off an incredible score and an absolutely lovely, lovely, lovely score. And I think that's probably the biggest star of this particular episode. So in closing here, Kyle, I'd love for you, as being one of the co-founders here on the Fandom Podcast Network and being back on Discoville, I'd love for you to let all the listeners know what is going on with the pantheon of shows we have here on our Fandom Podcast Network.
Oh, well, we're quite busy around here on the Fandom Podcast Network. And of course, let's talk a little bit about The Land of the Immortals, Blood of Kings, which you, Norman, and Kevin co-host. And right now you guys are doing season 2, Skip It or See It. And well, it's a very popular segment there. Of course, we have Culture Clash, our show about weekly fandom news, reviews, and whatever other crazy things we can find up. And we've got a lot of great specials we've done with that, including covering Cobra Kai, Deadpool, and we have an upcoming special on Solo. Over at Couch Potato Theater, it's all about Mad Max right now. As Adam O'Brien, our Australian correspondent, is bringing us Maximum Couch Potato Theater. We recently put out the first part, which covered the original Mad Max. And Kevin and I joined Adam recently to record part two, covering the Road Warrior. And of course, we travel through the time warp. And right now, it's all about the year of 1985, as the lovely Aaron Gill says, the most 80th year of the 1980s, as we cover all of the movies of 1985. Of course, our good friends over at Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast, Tom Caldwell, Brandon Shea Matala, and Chris High, bringing you everything you need to know about the master of suspense. And finally, we're diving back into the end zone with our off-season special covering all the free agent moves and the draft and everything else going on in the National Football League. But we also have something very special coming up. And Kevin, I want you to tell the people what's coming.
Yes, we're going to have about a once-a-month show called the Hair Metal Podcast. Itch I had to scratch talking about all of the bands that made some sort of impact from the mid to late 80s and even very early 90s, which eventually became the death of hair metal. So look for that. We got some fun guests coming up as well.
It wasn't the Aquanet shortage?
What's that, Kyle?
I said it wasn't the Aquanet shortage?
No. But we'll definitely talk about that.
I heard, and this can be completely, I don't know, disavowed. I heard that there was a formulation change in Aquanet, and that's what ended the hair metal scene in the 1990s.
No, it was Nirvana.
They just weren't getting the, they just weren't getting the body.
I think Eddie Vedder might have had a part in that too.
I think Smells Like Teen Spirit, that opening intro, is what killed hair metal.
And I hope you actually cover that, because there was a huge kind of cultural and seismic shift in the music scene.
Yes, there was. I was part of that. I know it well.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. This was a really fantastic discussion about episode 4, on the Orville here on our Quantum Drive rewatch. So I'm Norm, and on behalf of my fellow Battleship pilots, Kevin and Kyle, thanks for everyone for listening. And join us again next time here on the Fandom Podcast Network for another episode of Discoville. Hailing frequencies are now closed.